I was born and raised in the city of Los Angeles. Before I completed my schooling at the University of California, in trouble quite a number of times for various violations of law. The most serious offense, one of having committed an armed robbery, in which I was sent to prison. Upon completion of the prison sentence, I went back to finish my schooling at the university. Then, at the outset of World War II, drafted into the United States Army, and in spite of the previous record, later commissioned as an officer in the Army, served as signal officer in charge of communication and radar in the southwestern sector of the Western Defense Command. Then, several years later, in grade of captain, was court-martialed by the Army for misuse of government priorities and misappropriation of government property. Was sentenced to be dismissed from the service, to forfeit pay and allowances, and to be confined at hard labor for 10 years. The Ninth Corps of the Army reduced this to 5 years. And then after a year of time in the federal prison, McNeil Island in the state of Washington, my case was reviewed by President Truman. Presidential pardon. I was ordered back to military service. Upon return to the military, I was assigned by the Air Force to tour colleges, lecturing on developments in the field of electronics. Finally, won an honorable discharge, went back to my home in Los Angeles. There, engaged in business as an engineering consultant, largely in research and design for industry in my chosen field, electronics. Shortly after opening this business, I was approached by the Los Angeles Police Department. They wanted me to aid them in the development of equipment for scientific investigation of crime. In their behalf, I developed equipment for wiretapping, eavesdropping, electronic pursuit of cars. It was the development of this equipment that brought the interest and attention of the Sheriff's Office in Los Angeles County, then various police departments across the country, federal agencies. The work was rather interesting, however limited due to their limitation in their budgets. It was limited in the scope of its pay. Consequently, I took interest in doing work for private detective agencies. This proved to be much more profitable. One retired New York police captain operating a detective agency on the Sunset Strip invited me to come to his place and meet one of his clients, the motion picture actor Mickey Rooney. Rooney was accompanied by an agent, but he did most of his own talking. He said, "Mr. Voss, I understand that you have a device that makes it possible to listen to telephone conversation without being anywhere near the telephone." And when I said this was true, he took out his wallet and a $500 bill and then a piece of paper. On the piece of paper, he wrote a number. He said, "If in the next 5 minutes you could record the conversation on this telephone number, the $500 is yours." At the time, Rooney wanted a divorce. California law requires upon separation or divorce that community property be divided equally between husband and wife, unless there are unusual circumstances. He wanted to prove the unusual circumstances. The recording that we made was a conversation that took place between his wife and another man. And ample evidence of what was going on, but not admissible as evidence in court, but sufficient so that he was able to take it home, rather threateningly dangle it over the head of his wife. She quickly settled out of court, saved him thousands of dollars in the property settlement. He was so pleased that word spread rather quickly through the Hollywood film circle as to the service rendered in his behalf. Soon I had a number of interesting clients. Men like Errol Flynn and Xavier Cugat and Dick Hames. Each time someone with big name or big reputation would come for such service, I'd raise the fees a little higher. I wasn't quite sure what I could charge and get away with, so I kept upping the fees. I felt if it ever got to the place where the fees were considered exorbitant, I could always take the information I gathered for him, sell it out to the other half of the family, and she would always pay off. It was a profitable business, doing work not only for film personalities, but in the passing of the days, businessmen that were curious about competition in the business world, politicians that wondered about their political opponents, and eventually one day a call from a man that I had never met but read much about, at that time reputed to be the boss of organized crime in the West. Curious as to what he wanted of me, I went to his plush home in the suburbs of Los Angeles, a rather plush office in the suburbs, out in the Sunset Strip in Hollywood. Ushered through his prosperous looking store, I was taken into an office in the rear, and here seated behind a massive semicircular desk sat this man Cohen, Mickey Cohen. I didn't have too long to wait and find what he had in mind. He said, "I understand you're the man that installs microphones for the police department." I told him this was true. He said, "I understand you installed a microphone in my home for the police department." I told him that wasn't true. And inwardly, I was hoping he would believe me, especially with the men he had standing around the wall. He didn't seem too upset with my answer. He said, "Well, Mr. Voss, maybe you're not the man that installed the microphone, but I have it on good authority that there is a microphone concealed in my home, and the police and FBI listen to everything I have to say. What I'm wondering is, could you go over to my house, locate this microphone, and take it out?" I said, "You get me all wrong. I'm in the business of putting them in. I never take them out." He reached into his pocket, pulled out a roll of $100 bills, started peeling them off one after another. He said, "Mr. Voss, are you sure you're not interested in looking for the microphone?" Well, my interest suddenly changed, and a short time later, I conducted the search for the microphone. Located it, removed it. It was this incident that caused Mickey Cohen to offer me a full-time job in his employ. The amount of money that he offered exceeded my income from all the other varied points. I accepted with one stipulation, that I be permitted to continue my work for law enforcement as well as to work with him in organized crime. Strangely enough, he agreed to this. And for a year that followed, I did just that, working for law enforcement on one hand, organized crime on the other. I probably could spend much of your time telling interesting stories of the inner operation of so-called syndicated crime. But sufficient to say that it was a number of years later, at the height of a career in this field, I made a decision that brought complete and total change to my life. I think people are often a little alarmed to find that I was raised in the home of a Baptist minister. And they often think of me as one perhaps that came up out of unfortunate circumstances. This is not true. As a boy, I attended church. I was president of the high school young people's group. Attended Wheaton College. Didn't last too long. I was expelled. I don't know why they carry me as an alumnus now, but they didn't for a long time. But I think if anyone had come to me in the years in which I was so deeply involved and said, "Are you a Christian?" I would have said yes. And if they had raised question as to why, I perhaps would have said, "Well, I believe there is a God. I believe that Jesus Christ is the greatest man that ever lived, the Savior of men. So I believe, now leave me alone." I think in my own mind in those days, I had it computed this way, that I was a disobedient person, and perhaps, as some would say, a backslider, and that someday I would say to God, "I'm sorry," and God would forgive me. It might be on my deathbed, but there would always be that last chance. To me, the important thing in life was money and what it could buy. In this field, my occupation, there was plenty of it. And I thought it would buy happiness. But inwardly, I was a miserable, restless man. Folks often wonder what caused me to attend the grand meeting. I wasn't one to go to church in those days. But a number of friends had invited me to hear this man. And then one day I noticed in the newspaper where a friend of mine, Stuart Hamlin, had, as they put it, got religion. And I thought to myself, nothing and no one could ever change Stuart Hamlin. When a few days later I heard him on his regular broadcast over KFWB in Hollywood, I was amazed as he said that he was giving up 21 consecutive years in radio broadcasting, selling a string of racehorses. And he went on to relate some of his own personal experience. And it was this, the invitations from others, a number of things, finally Well, on the particular day, an uncle of mine had passed away. I went to pay my respects at the funeral parlor, then feeling rather badly about his death, I took a ride to the beach. And it was rather gloomy out there, as it often can be, sunny in Los Angeles, and the beach rather poor weather and foggy. I decided I'd stop at Cohen's house on the way back into town. He was always home on a Sunday, but this particular Sunday he wasn't there. Then I decided to visit a bar where many of the fellas hung out. No one was there, just a bartender shining glasses. Driving down the same boulevard, Washington Boulevard, I soon came to the place where the huge canvas tent was erected and thought, why not? Went in, found myself full of criticism as I sat in the tent, of the people around me, of the program, but tremendously impressed with the presentation made by Mr. Graham. And all of his comments were centered around just one theme: what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world but lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? The meeting ended. The invitation was given. And one little guy came down the aisle to where I was sitting and tapped me on the shoulder as others were going to the front to indicate their decision for Christ. He said, "Brother, are you saved? Don't you want to go forward?" And I always hated people like that. And I thought to myself, if he says one more word, just one more word. I had it all figured out, the place in the sawdust where he was going down and the place in the side of the tent where I was going out. But you know, strangely enough, he never said another thing. But he stood there, just a very small in stature, stood there and with bowed head. And he had a grip on my arm, and I thought, well, I'd just give him a nudge to tell him to turn loose. Then out of the corner of my eye, I could see that his head was bowed. He evidently was praying, and I thought, you can't hit a man when he's praying. But it seemed he didn't know when to quit. But you know, as he stood there, my attention went back to Mr. Graham and the one statement he made that seemed to just cap it all off. He said, you know, there's a man here tonight that has heard this story many times before, and he knows this is the decision he should make. And yet again tonight he hardens his heart, and with pride he stiffens his neck. He's determined to leave without making this decision, but for that man it may be his last opportunity. I had always said, there's plenty of time. There's plenty of time. Plenty of time. It's hard to try and tell someone else what all takes place inside and out. I believe that the Spirit of God in each man's life comes and in one way or another brings a man face to face with the importance of this decision. I finally turned to the little guy. I said, all right, I'll go. And I walked down the long aisle and back into a little tent that they had set up off to one side, prayer tent. There, kneeling in the sawdust and dirt, I invited, well, I think it's so easy to use words. I do remember the prayer. I was quite confused in many ways. But I said, God, if you think Jim Voss means business with you, Won't you mean business with Jim Voss? I knew that if I meant this, that it would mean not only my severance of connections within the syndicate, but I felt there were many wrongs that needed to be made right. It just seemed impossible, the whole thing. That's why I said that if you'll help me over the hurdles that lie in the road ahead, I'll give you my life and all that I've got. I'll hold nothing back. The days that followed that decision were days that were filled with a lot of confusion and upset. I thought that I would... I just felt an inward compulsion to go back and make things right with people. I'd spent so much of my life cheating, lying, stealing, swindling, embezzling, robbing. The path of restitution, not determined by any court, but just personal conviction, was a long one. Actually, it was several years before the long list was repaid. In those first days, I did get around to see many of the people I felt that things had to be made right with. Now, I'll never forget my fear of how do I go about telling my boss. And then that was pretty well settled when the newspapers came out with a big headline that told the story. And when I called him at first, he kind of chuckled as though, you know, it can't be for real. What's the gimmick? And then when he found that I was serious, he wanted to meet the man. Billy Graham. Take a long time to tell all the story of what was involved in that, but we did go to see him, Billy Graham and myself. Talked at great length. The last thing he said to Mr. Graham as he was leaving that night, he said, "You know, I can't understand it. I've given Jim anything he's wanted. And there isn't anything I wouldn't give him now. But he's leaving me and he's going with you. You must have something I haven't got." He found it hard to understand. Then he called me and wanted me to come back and called me on the telephone. I went back and talked at great length one night, several hours. A little back room of his home. The last thing he said, he put out his hand. He said, "Jim, I want you to make me a promise." And I knew that I'd be subpoenaed for testimony. I'd perjured myself in a case involving part of this organization and police officials in Los Angeles. I knew that had to be made right, but I was curious when he said, "I want you to make me a promise." I thought he was going to say, "Just be quiet. Much you can talk about, but be quiet." But instead, as I put my hand in his, he said, "I want you to promise me that you'll never go back to the old way of living. Hang on to what you've got. A lot of the guys aren't going to like it. But if the whole world turns against you for the decision you've made, remember there's one little Jew right here that thinks the world of you for the decision you've made and the guts you've had to stand up for." It was a long time before I got back that way again, that is, to his home. I'd been, shortly after that time, subpoenaed by the government to testify against Cohen. There was a lot of speculation that when he finished the 5-year prison sentence that he would be gunning for me. I guess some people believed it because when it neared the time for his release, an insurance company that carried an accidental death policy on my life canceled out. And yet we met together shortly after his release from prison. Talked at great length. I asked him at the time, I said, how much money have you got left? And he held up his hand like that, nothing. After applying a little pressure, he said, I do have a few government bonds, but I don't dare cash them or Internal Revenue will take it. My wife and I, at that time, lived in Los Angeles, and we had a little Ford coupe. I said, you really need a car. Why don't you take ours? And at least it'll help you get around. My wife and I had talked about it and thought we'd just like to show the kindness of God to him. I wish there were time to fill in all the details, to tell you how this kindness, in a rather involved way, led to his second trial a few years ago. I had encouraged him to forget his old ways, to find some new line of endeavor. Often talked to him about the things of God and of Christ. But what you ought to do? You ought to sit down and strangely enough, and you'll see what my purpose is as I go along here, and I must get through. I leave some time for the speaker. I asked them how long I was supposed to speak tonight, and they said, So I guess I have another hour and a half. But I've never told this portion of the story publicly, but I encouraged him. I said, Mick, what you ought to do is come out here each morning that is to my office, and sit down with one of the girls and just, off the top of your head, tell the story of your whole life. And she'll put it in written form. And one day it'll be a saleable commodity. But not until your life is really changed. And I thought it'd kind of keep him occupied, and thinking about the past, he might profit. And also it would give me opportunity to talk to him about things of God. Well, he did just that. What I didn't know until several years later, I found in a courtroom where he was being tried for evasion of income tax, was the little manuscript that we had typed up for him of the things he had dictated to this girl. He took to many of his friends. And it was fascinating reading, tremendously so. And most of them in the motion picture world and prominent people in Hollywood that he knew. And he said, they're going to do a book, they're going to do a movie. And now if you could just loan me $5,000 until this picture comes out, make a long story short, it was pointed out in the trial in federal court that this humble little beginning, he had mushroomed into over $1 million in income. Loans from this person and that one and the other. At least that's what he told Uncle Sam, was they're all loans so they're not taxable. But in court it was proven that really... Well, as the prosecutor pointed out, the federal prosecutor, really his main ability in life was as a con man. And so no one really was going to publish the book, and no one really was going to do any movie, but that he had sold this idea to many people as a con man, and the money, this $1 million or more in loans from many different people, was the fruit of his labor, and it was therefore taxable income. And on this he was convicted. And probably many of you know the story. He was sent to prison for 15 years. And while serving time a couple of years ago in the Atlanta penitentiary, he was hit over the head by an insane inmate. And paralyzed. Most of his body paralyzed. A lot of people didn't think he'd live. It wasn't long after that I got a letter from him. As bit by bit he made some recovery. But I'll never forget the letter. He had recalled a verse from the Bible that I left with him the last time I saw him in a court, federal court in Los Angeles. And the verse said this: "Cursed is the man that trusteth man, and that maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord. For he shall be like a heath in the desert. He shall not see when good cometh. He'll inhabit the parched places of the wilderness, in a salt land not inhabited." And it goes on to say, "But blessed is the man that trusteth in the Lord, and whose hope the Lord is, for he shall be like a tree planted by the waters." Shortly after this incident that brought such a crushing blow physically, he said, "I have thought again and again of that verse from the Bible. And ever since that time, we have corresponded rather regularly. But up until just yesterday, I had not seen him. And yesterday I stopped on my way here. I fly my own plane. And I stopped off in Springfield, arranged with the federal government to see him. It was a sad, sad experience. I still feel myself somewhat shaken from it. Man so proud of his physique and his appearance and his dress, as he was aided in his walk into the room by attendants, and by one of these little push deals, as he hung on and found it extremely difficult to make his feet work. Just really a hopeless wreck of the man I once knew. We talked at great length yesterday about the things of God. And perhaps the most encouraging sign, for here's a man I've prayed for years, but perhaps the most encouraging sign was his comment that maybe God had permitted all of this to make him think more seriously the things that we had talked about so often. Oh, together we reminisced about a lot of old times, old people. You know what? There was a group. Papers used to make fun of it in a way, because though Mickey Cohen is not a man big in stature, they used to refer to him, jokingly, as Snow White and his seven dwarfs. because the seven key men around him were all equivalent in size to myself. And they used to picture us that way. But I was asking him what had happened. Of course, many of you know that just before I came to know Christ, Nettie Herbert was shot and killed, Sunset Strip. Hooky Rothman was killed in the doorway of my laboratory in an attempt on Cohen's life. There had been the bombing of his home on several occasions. I pulled the bomb out from under the house in one of these. But as we sat and talked yesterday, in a way it was, I was sad. Mike Howard, the fellow that headed up his bookmaking empire, killed himself by hanging in a New York apartment. Well, just one by one, we went down the list, and the only two still living, Mickey Cohen and myself. I wish you'd pray for this man. People often ask if they can write to him or something, but you can't correspond with him because of the regulations of the federal government. I wish you'd just pray for him very earnestly, because I believe, I really do, as never before, that he's near the kingdom and that he'll come to know Christ. I believe that one day he'll be a great witness for him, perhaps even like Saul of Tarsus, who became the Paul. He has nothing but time on his hands and law alone all day long, where he's kept in isolation lest someone else do injury to him. And he reads and reads. But mostly, he's reading the Bible. Well, I've taken far too much time to tell you that story. Sufficient to say, in the passing of the years, well, it's been a delightfully happy experience of following Christ, a joyous life. For a long time, I wondered whether I was really a Christian before and really a backslider, as some would say, but I came to the conclusion just through study that I wasn't saved, I was lost, really lost, in those years. Not just a backslider. For one that believes is one that trusts, and at the same time obeys. And I'm thoroughly convinced that anything short of a total invasion of the heart and life by Jesus Christ cannot be salvation. But when he invades the life, he makes a man a totally new creature. I wish there were time to tell you of something of the recent years. Many of you know that for a number of years I devoted my time to the field of evangelism. But in the last 9 years, I've been working in the slums of New York City with extremely difficult youth. Kids, they say, well, they're hopeless. Nothing can be done. But we've seen God change their lives, even as he changed mine. I plan to spend the rest of my life in this one square mile of New York City to prove that there is an answer in the power of Jesus Christ. I believe that Christ can do far and beyond what millions of dollars invested in poverty programs could ever accomplish. Personally, I believe those dollars wasted. You can change appearance, but only Christ can change a life. and as long as he gives me strength. In this dark corner, I will gladly serve him and rejoice in the privilege that is mine to share with others this good news. Perhaps at the luncheon tomorrow, I'll have opportunity to tell you a little more about the work there and what's been happening of late. It's been a joy to share these moments with you. I'd like to close with just a poem that's oft-quoted. You've heard it before, but it expresses something of my feeling. It was battered and scarred. The auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on an old violin, but he held it up with a smile. "What am I bid, good folk?" he cried. "Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar? Then two, only two. $2 will make it three, going for three." But no, from the room way back, a gray-haired man came forward, picked up the bow, wiping the dust from the old violin, tightening the loosened strings, he played a melody that was pure and sweet, like a caroling angel would sing. The music ceased. The auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "Now what am I bid for this old violin?" He held it up with a bow. $1,000, who'll make it two? $2,000, who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going, gone," cried he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, "We don't quite understand. What changed its worth?" Quick came the reply, "The touch of the master's hand." And many a boy with life out of tune is battered and scarred with sin, auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, he travels on, going once, going twice, going almost gone, but the master comes. And the foolish crowd can never quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand.